are about to be spoken here with the Extreme Life of Matt Hardy, episode 40, presented exclusively by Podcast Heat and AdFreeShows.com. I, of course, am John Alba, joined as I am every single week by the broken one, the woken one, the spoken one himself, Mr. Matt Hardy. 40 episodes. How crazy is that?
40 deep. Insane, man. It's crazy. Time has flown.
The podcast is almost as old as Shane Helms. Well, no, it's not almost.
Oh, come on.
We can't lie about that.
That's absurd, John.
We've got another 55 million years to go to get to that point. So
we'll never catch up.
Never going to catch that. But how are you, man? I heard it was a bit of a hellacious travel week for you to DC here.
Yeah, it was all right. Yeah, I am here in DC. We're here live tonight on Wednesday. We're also going to be live on Friday. So spending 3 days in the lovely Washington, D.C. So I'm hoping on Thursday I can go out and see some sights and get some new photos that I can post.
Nice. You have a favorite spot in D.C.?
No, not necessarily. But there's a lot of things. I've been to D.C. so many times over the years, obviously. But I've never went out and, like, seen all the sights, so to say. Usually I'm here and I'm working and it's like, go, 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 go. But I actually have Thursday and it's completely off. So I'm hoping to go out and see some stuff and you know, kind of take in some of the DC culture.
Would you say DC is among the worst traffic you've dealt with?
DC has, yes, DC has some of the worst traffic I've ever encountered. I mean, that's been since day one of coming here. I mean, whenever you're like right on the north or south side of DC, especially if you get caught during rush hour, it's brutal.
Yes, it is. It is one of the most congested areas in the United States. So
yeah,
I empathize for anyone who has to deal with that on a daily basis.
Oh my God. It's just such a wild card because, you know, it could be 30 minutes. It could be 2 hours. You never know.
I am excited to see AEW run DC. That was where the first Dynamite was run, correct? If I'm not mistaken. And now you're celebrating 3 years of Dynamite, which is just
the anniversary
wild. Wild. It's yours and Rebecca Hardy's anniversary as we tape this today. Congratulations.
Yes. Thank you very much. 9 years of marriage. We've made it a lot further than most people thought we would.
Would you like to give a little anniversary shout out to the Queen here?
I would. Happy 9th anniversary, Queen Rebecca. I'm so happy that we found one another. I love you. And thank you for being my wife, thank you for being my ride or die who goes so hard for me. And thank you for sacrificing so much to create these four beautiful children we have. I love you so, so much.
The gaggle of children and the gothic baby, even, who is very happy, according to TikTok, that her mom is back from Italy.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. The gothic baby's half-ass over.
Very much so. And it's also, as we tape this today, October 5th, today's the 25th anniversary of the day I fell in love with pro wrestling.
Oh, really? Okay.
Bad Blood 97. Shawn Michaels, The Undertaker, Hell in a Cell, and some big-ass, big red machine storming down to the ring, and that's got to be Kane.
There you have it.
What a moment, man. What a moment.
That was an amazing match. I'm a huge Shawn Michaels fan as is anyway, but I love that run and I remember loving that match with him and Taker so much, that first ever Hell in a Cell match.
That was the last 5-star match that Dave Meltzer gave out for WWE until CM Punk versus John Cena in 2011. How crazy is that?
It's crazy. It's also crazy you know that in some ways too, but it's so cool. that's amazing.
That was the day I fell in love with pro wrestling. So that's a pretty significant day for me.
I love how you know your history, John.
I call that the Big Bang moment. Every guy has their Big Bang moment when you knew. That's the day I knew I love pro wrestling. So
that's it. Like my Big Bang moment was WrestleMania 4, where Macho Man won the tournament and became the World Heavyweight Champion.
And you'll never forget that.
Yeah.
So that's where it's at, brother. But 25 years, absolutely insane. Now, we have a very... This is going to be a deep episode here, and I want to give a forewarning to anyone listening to this. It is going to be a heavy one. We're going to be talking about a very rough period in Matt's life when he was released by WWE in 2010 and some of the things he was going through. But the beauty of this podcast, Matt, is that you are so transparent and honest. Why are you okay talking about a period of time like this, and why is it important for you?
I mean, it's my life. It's actual events that happened, and it was one of the greatest life lessons I've ever learned. And I feel like by sharing my story, it can help other people as well. And I own it, man. I'm accountable. And this is one of the reasons this period of my life is what really taught me to be accountable and to own your shit. Like if you have something going on, whether it's right or whether it's wrong, like you have to own it because it's yours. And at the end of the day, you can't like be a bitch who makes excuses or complains about other people. And I went through a little bit of that during this period, but like I own it. I'm accountable for all of it. And like I said last week, you know, at 48 years young, I know who I am, and there's a victory in that. And I am very comfortable talking about everything that I've been through because it is my story and it's my experiences. And there's someone out there that is intimidated to talk about these same subjects, and I feel like I can help them. I feel like I can share my story, and it will give them hope, and they will know that it will get better. You can get through anything.
This is going to be a special one. I hope everyone enjoys it and takes notes from it, because I think you're going to inspire a lot of people with this. But before we get into all of that, Matt, last week we talked about Tracy Cadell, we talked about Omega, and we talked about Cameron Grimes,
right?
And the response we got from that episode, that it was truly one of the hidden gems of this podcast, and I fully agree. It was, I think, one of our very best, and it seems like Cameron Grimes really enjoyed it too.
Yeah, he was I was so happy. He sent me this lovely text, just buzzing with joy and glee after he listened to the podcast, and said he loved it so much. And he said, thank you for telling my story and telling it so accurately and just with so much love. So I'm happy he loved it. That makes me very proud. And it really was. It was like a love letter to my late friend, Tracy Cadell, and also a guy who feels like my nephew, Trevor Cadell, Cameron Grimes.
That Shannon Moore story popped me so big. So we gotta maybe one day we'll get that recreated in real time. Who's to say? Never know. You might see one more Shannon Moore powerbomb.
In the pro wrestling business and the life of Matt Hardy. Never say never.
Never say never. Well, we said we got great feedback from it. That's because we got all these great reviews on it, including how many stars, Matt Hardy?
Five star reviews.
And we've been telling you for months, leave us those five star reviews, send them to us, and we would give a personalized video message to one of our Matt Hardy podcast followers. And we have picked one, Matt Hardy. And I know this is a real special one for you, because this is a guy that leaves us a five star review every single week. He literally writes out a new one and sends a tweet to us every single week. And that, Matt, is our friend Cameron at 1990 Hardy One. And Cameron, you're going to get a personalized video from Matt and I as a token of appreciation. And how about that? His name's Cameron, of all names, Matt Hardy.
There you have it, man. How fitting. Thank you very much, Cameron. Thank you for being a very loyal, dedicated listener to the Extreme Life of Matt Hardy. John and I greatly appreciate you. And please keep leaving those reviews and continue to spread the word, because we're growing slowly but surely. We're growing here, and people are learning the content that we're producing is some of the best out there. We both feel very confident in that.
Might even say it's elite. So with that said, Matt Hardy, it's time to get down to business. It's time for episode 40's Matt Fact.
Matt Fact, Matt believes it is never too late to change.
That's something a lot of people struggle with.
Indeed.
A lot of people think that it's either difficult to change or that people can't change. So you believe against that grain?
100%. As long as there is air in your lungs, as long as your heart is beating, as long as your brain is pulsing, it is never too late to change. Never too late to change. Some people get defeated because they feel like they're so deep in a hole that they can't crawl out, they can't get out, but it is never too late to change. Remember that. It is never, ever too late to change. You can always turn it around.
Well, at the end of the summer of 2009, there are some changes in the House Hardy. Jeff Hardy has left WWE. We covered that on our CM Punk episode. They feuded. There's a cage match. Jeff has to leave. He's done. The plan at the time was for him to do some other projects. You talked about that. Then he was going to come back. Where do you remember Jeff's head being at that time? And did you feel like you were in a good space as he was leaving? Did you see opportunity on the wall there for you, perhaps?
No, I mean, I was sad he was leaving. You know, it was I knew it was going. I was going to miss him. It was going to be different not having him around. I always love when we're together because that always allows us to do what was our initial dream, and that is be a tag team and be the Hardy Boys. So yeah, I obviously was very motivated and driven to do things myself, and I figured there would be some opportunities there. But I always like having Jeff around when we're in the same company and we're on the same page, and there's always the opportunity to revisit the tag team of Matt Jeff Hardy. That is always best case scenario in my book.
Oh, we talked about on that episode, but you were positioned into that feud a little bit after Jeff left. You and Punk right. did some work together, and on some house shows, you're teaming with Batista and The Undertaker against CM Punk, Chris Jericho in the show. That is a lot of talent there. And on the surface level, Matt, that seems like a pretty good space to be in. Were you feeling okay about things at that point there towards the end of 2009?
Yeah, I mean, it was I definitely enjoyed those matches. Anytime you're in there with the upper echelon and the tippity top guys, that's always a good feeling, and that's always where you want to be. So yeah, I really did enjoy those matches, and we were not just myself and Jeff, but we were we were at a point where we were both so established that people knew who we were, and we were pretty mainstream names at that time. So we had like put in the time, and we definitely carried a lot of star power. And even without Jeff there, still the name of Matt Hardy carried a lot of star power at that time.
What did you feel like the office's perception was of you at that time?
I think they realized that I was a talent that was over, that was a very hard worker, that was going to do whatever they wanted me to do. They trusted me in there with whatever kind of talent it was, whether it was a big monster and I needed to work around him, or whether it was a quick, fast guy who I kind of would base for, whatever it may be. They trusted me pretty much in every environment. I was a very reliable, trusted talent that they knew they could turn to work any kind of match.
So after those house shows, you move into the Intercontinental Championship picture. There's a bunch of triple threats. There's some fatal four ways. Rey Mysterio's involved. Dolph Ziggler's involved. John Morrison's involved. Again, a lot of talent. You're not winning any of these matches. You're kind of just in the mix there. You just came off your ECW title run. Jeff just had a world championship run. Did you feel like you could have been positioned for a potential world title feud coming out of all that stuff?
I know initially whenever I turned on Jeff, the initial plan, but it changed because I don't think I got over to the level of being a heel that they desired me to be at, was I was going to work with Jeff. And when that was all said and done, there was something penciled in that I was going to work with John Cena for a little while. But that never ended up happening. Obviously I got hurt, and I was real beat up at this time. Physically, I was in not a good place. Physically, I was beat up, especially like my back and my hips. This is when it really set in hard for the very first time. And I felt like I could be in a more top tier position as far as working matches and working with other people. But physically, too, I was having a lot of issues. And whenever I had that scenario where my hand was broke and I worked around it, then there was that deal where my intestines literally popped through my abdominal wall and I had to have that corrected. I mean, I was pretty beat up because like I had so many other injuries, I was like overcompensating and it was causing me to get hurt even more. And I should have just asked for time off at that point already before we get into this. But me being, you know, this man of a workhorse mentality, you know, I was going to try and work through everything and work around it.
How were you coping with that stuff?
Well, I remember there was one point in time where I told Johnny Ace, and I'd said this, was right around the time towards the end of the, you know, being the U.S. champion right before the ECW deal. And I remember saying like, Johnny, you know, like my back is pretty beat up. There's one point where I wake up in the morning and I like can't stand to get out of bed, and I have to half-ass crawl to get in the bathtub, and I run a hot bath, and I get in there and soak and try and loosen up my hips and my lower back a little bit because I was having issues. And he just said, well, we just got you in a really good spot. And, you know, we want to keep you on the road. You're someone that we trust. You can work with anyone. Like, just go to the doctor and see what they can do for you. But we really can't afford to give you any time off. And then when you go to the doctor and you say, well, I'm having these issues, you know, I'm in constant pain because of my lower back and my hips. And, you know, is there anything you can do for me without doing surgery? Is there any kind of therapy or rehabilitation I can have, whatever? They say, well, stop doing what you're doing, first and foremost. And really the only other thing we can say is like, well, take these pills. They help relieve the pain. And then take these pills. They help relax your muscles so you won't be as tight. You know, and that's where it starts. And it's a very slippery slope.
And I think there needs to be some perspective here for some fans listening that in that time, coming out of the Attitude Era, Ruthless Aggression Era, all that, mm-hmm. you take time off for injury, someone else is stepping in, taking your spot, and there's a good chance you might not get that back. Unless you are an established John Cena, Batista type guy, there's a good chance you might not get that back. Thankfully, that mentality has changed a little bit now in wrestling, where if people are hurting.
It was even at this point, it was a very dog-eat-dog world. You know what I mean? Like, if you're hurt, if you're injured and you step off, like, all this hard work you've done to, like, gain this headway, you can lose immediately, you know, just if you're hurt. And it's really nothing that you do, and it doesn't really reflect your work ethic or anything else. It's just you're injured. And it's a crazy occupation is it anyway. I mean, we're slamming our bodies into wood and steel, you know, 4 to 5 nights a week.
Yeah,
you know, so it was a very bad mentality back then, and guys were so worried about that, about like if you take time off or if you leave or you're hurt, you're going to lose your spot. And it's so good that has changed over time. And fortunately, the wrestling business has kind of been forced to mirror reality in many ways, which is like, you know, that's not something that you do intentionally, get hurt or whatever. It happens in pro wrestling. I mean, we're, you know, living, breathing stuntmen that go out and do live TV every single week, you know, sometimes a couple times a week. And if you get hurt, it's just part of the gig. It's nothing anyone is doing intentionally.
Later in the year, you end up in a few elimination matches. You're at Bragging Rights, which is a 14-man tag match. You're in Survivor Series. But you're never quite getting that singles opportunity to really show that you can be a top player on the SmackDown side, which is fascinating because when Jeff was coming out, they brought you back and turned you babyface. They put you in that program with Punk for a short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
It felt like there was a need for some major babyface credibility on SmackDown, and Matt Hardy could have been that guy. Did you have that in the back of your head?
I mean, I obviously wanted to optimize whatever I was doing in any position. Yeah, I mean, I wanted to contribute. If I'm wrestling anywhere, I want to be a contributor. You know, at whatever point in my career it is, that's kind of who I am. You know, if I'm going to be performing for you, I want to be someone who is contributing to the show. And yeah, like obviously I was looking for an opportunity at that time.
So the first half of 2010 is kind of a strange one for you. You're working quite a bit, even with Jeff off the table in WWE. And on the first major TNA Impact of the year, Jeff Hardy shows up. It's the night that Eric Bischoff and Hulk Hogan take over TNA. They go head-to-head with Monday Night Raw. And on that night's Raw, Bret Hart makes amends with Shawn Michaels. It's a massive night in wrestling. I'll never forget watching it. It was probably the last time that I truly was flipping back and forth between channels, anxious to see what was going to happen. And Jeff showing up was a big shocker moment. What did you think of Jeff showing up in TNA? When did he tell you that was going down? And what did you make of TNA's decision to go head-to-head with Raw at that point?
I knew Jeff was going to be showing up a few weeks out. It really left a bad taste in Jeff's mouth whenever, you know, as I said that one time, like he had left and he wanted to take time off. And Jeff once again was very hurt. And he was also dealing with his issues, obviously, as well, especially, you know, like relying on pills to like get through days and whatnot because of his injuries. But then once he had the deal where he was arrested and there was the Punk promo, which we addressed in the Punk episode, that really rubbed Jeff the wrong way. And then he had people reaching out to him from TNA, and they offered him a great deal with a very small amount of dates to do. And then he told me he was going to do it. And I mean, I didn't disagree with him. I mean, it sounded like a good deal. Whenever they went head to head, I thought it was pretty aggressive to try and do, but I knew at the end of the day, it wasn't going to end up being a great decision. It didn't feel like it. I don't feel like TNA had been around that long. It wasn't established. It didn't have the star power. And it felt like they were doing themselves a disservice in many ways because they were producing some pretty good content, and they did have some star power, and they were building their brand. But just to go head to head immediately with the number one company in the world that's been around for so many years and has so much equity already, I don't think that was the best of decisions.
there's another timeline where AEW doesn't exist because TNA never decides to go head to head with Raw, and TNA is the viable number two company in the US. And it's wild to think how different things could have been. But yeah. Jeff showing up there is a big deal, and he's a big time star coming in there. So,
yes.
So people were really into that. Did you have it in the back of your head that TNA might be on your radar?
Definitely. I mean, if Jeff's there's an in, and that was definitely in the back of my mind, for sure.
Keep in mind, Jeff's being presented as a big-time main eventer there. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, at this time, January 2010, you're working matches with Great Khali, Ezekiel Jackson, and the new Hart Dynasty, and Maria Kanellis. And there's nothing wrong with any of those individuals, but there's a clear difference in presentation of Matt Hardy versus Jeff Hardy.
Right.
It's something that I have to envision sits kind of in the back of your head.
Well, one thing for me that was very frustrating, I think, with WWE, is just I had this very strange barometer, I feel like, as a talent. Because on my own, very established, people do like me, over, trustworthy. Very, you know, every time when I go out, you know, I'm going to produce, you know, every single week. I'm a hard worker. But there was like the standard that because Jeff was my brother and my partner, I feel like people always expected like, well, if he's not as over as Jeff, then they, you know, we can't use him in the same way or whatever.
In the mud,
you know? Yeah. And that's one of the things that was very frustrating. I remember there was one point where, you know, I told Vince right when I first turned heel, and I was trying to get the opportunity, you know, back in 2002. And I said, look, like, I am very popular. Jeff is extremely popular. I know you think that Jeff is like 20 times or 10 times more popular than I am. But I promise I am very popular on my own. And like, let me step out and let me have my own opportunity. And like, don't judge me against Jeff. Like, judge me on my own. And I feel like that was always a sticking point with WWE. They always looked like, oh, Jeff's really over Matt. Not as much. Maybe it's because of Jeff or whatever. But like, I felt like I never got the credit of all the hard work and the equity that I created in myself as far as being Matt Hardy, as far as being a talent that was over on his own. And I wanted to be judged on my own, not being judged as the brother of Jeff Hardy, because Jeff is like this anomaly that is like extremely popular and extremely beloved, you know? So I always felt that was kind of, that was kind of I was swimming upstream in so many ways because of that deal, because of Jeff's popularity. I was always compared to it, and it was always like a barometer to me, I felt like, with the main office, especially with Vince.
Well, you're named a mentor on the first season of the original NXT, and Justin Gabriel is your mentee. We're going to talk about this long form next year. This was actually a audience member suggested topic from our Extreme Life and Matt Hardy faithful. They wanted to hear about that first season of NXT. So we're going to cover that next year here on the podcast.
Right.
But what do you think of the idea of pairing you there with Justin Gabriel, a great athlete in his own right, and you're kind of viewed as the veteran mentor here?
It was cool to be selected and be put in that spot. And I remember I thought it was a unique concept that they were trying out. You know, there were some of the silly contests that they did on NXT back in the day that were just really absurd, which was I don't know. Once again, it's an entertainment company too, and I can't be too critical of things. I'm the guy who did Broken Matt Hardy, you know. So they definitely tried some out of the box stuff, but I enjoyed that. I enjoyed that time there, and I enjoyed being the mentor of Justin Gabriel. And we actually became pretty good friends through that.
Great talent. Always felt like he didn't get his just due in WWE. I thought he could do a lot more. Let's fast forward to WrestleMania in 2010. Here is WrestleMania 26. You're in the Money in the Bank ladder match. Jack Swagger, Jake Hager, he wins.
Right.
It's an attraction match at Mania. You're in there with eight other guys. Great spot, but at the same time, kind of hard to stand out. And when you think about where you were a year ago at WrestleMania in an attraction match in your own right, in a feud, a blood feud with your brother.
Right.
How are you feeling about that?
I was happy to be in that Money in the Bank ladder match. That's definitely my environment. That's definitely my vibe. So I was happy to be in that. And I remember I liked the match. I was just happy to be part of WrestleMania. At that point, we were kind of getting down to it where, like, you know, you have to be a pretty big star to end up being on WrestleMania, because there were a lot of people that didn't make WrestleMania at that time. So I was happy to be part of it for sure.
Mentally, physically, where are you at this time, spring of 2010?
I mean, I'm burnt out. I'm beat up. You know, I think you can even tell, like, you know, I couldn't train the way I wanted to train, mentally, you know, I wasn't thrilled with everything. And I feel like once again, with Jeff showing up at TNA, I feel like that was also a strike against me in many ways. You know, they couldn't punish Jeff. You know, if they were mad that Jeff went to TNA, they couldn't punish Jeff, but they could punish the next best thing, which would be me. So I just felt like, you know, they were never going to pull the trigger on me fully once Jeff was there, because they probably figured, like, once my deal was up, then I'm just going to end up going to TNA and join Jeff. So between the physical injuries and just the pro wrestling in general, especially WWE, is so tough emotionally. And then once you start taking pills to feel better physically, there's times where you get emotionally down or mentally down, and you go, oh, well, this kind of makes the physical pain go away. I think it'll make the emotional and mental pain go away too. And there was way too much of that going on with me at that time.
How many pills did you find yourself taking a day?
Never a crazy amount, but, you know, it was probably a point where, you know, later on during 2010, when I was at my highest point, I mean, there was probably a point where I would take, you know, 5 Vicodin and 10 Somas a day, you know, throughout the day, you know, wow. a few doses throughout the day. You take some in the morning to kind of get you started. Then you take some in the afternoon, then you take some in the night to go to sleep.
I don't think it can be understated how big of an opiate problem pro wrestling had in mid to late 2000s.
No. I mean, and once again, keep in mind, I was the guy who, I didn't have a beer until I was 25 years old. Whenever I had my knee surgery, you know, I was given these pain medication and Valium for the pain, and I threw them all away. So I was like, fuck that. I mean, that was my mentality. But, you know, I'd got to a point where I was so physically beat up and just like emotionally frustrated, you know, and just it's so mentally taxing, you know, being in the WWE at a time like that, you know, and then just like, oh, I don't want to have to deal with that pain. And that's one of those things. It's a very bitch thing to do. And I was being a bitch at many times, and I've learned to be better and stronger since then. But it's a very slippery slope, man. Anytime those pills are, you know, anytime there's a prescription and some people are given pain pills or muscle relaxers or Valium or whatever it may be, you know, it's a very slippery slope, because like once you start taking those things and you become reliant on them, and then like it kind of like takes away the trauma of real life and the real world. And that's a very scary thing, because like once you start going there, it's very easy to become reliant on it.
I got to know Matt Morgan pretty well during my time in Orlando. And he is a huge, huge outspoken advocate for opiate management, because he was overseas in Italy on a tour and puking blood because of the addiction that he had with opiates. It was a horrible, horrible. What's the right word? It was a demon that was going through the locker rooms of pro wrestling companies at that time, especially at that time. So it was unavoidable, because so many people were dealing with those hard schedules, right? And they're dealing with those road injuries, those nagging injuries. So pills are everywhere. They're surrounding you.
Everywhere. I mean, and you look back too, like the generation before me, you look at all those premature deaths, you know, guys dying in their late 30s, in their 40s, you know, just their schedules were insane. And, you know, promoters would treat them like they were machines, and they're not. They're human beings. And it's really easy to get in that mindset of like, you have to be a workhorse. You have to go, 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 go. But we are human beings, and that can't be forgotten.
So after the ladder match at WrestleMania, you're going to work with a guy who you'd become very familiar with over the years, and that's Drew McIntyre. But this is super young Drew McIntyre here. He had just been elected the chosen one by Vince McMahon. He's going to be a future world champion, Vince says. Quite an endorsement. How'd you feel about the decision to be put with him at this stage in his career?
I've always been cool with that. Like working with guys, you know, once again, as I said, I was very trustworthy to the WWE and the offices, you know, office staff. They knew that I would take new young green guys and I would, you know, try and lead them in the right direction. And I would give them all that I had and I would bust my ass for them. You know, I did it with Jack Swagger, for instance. You know, he was also someone that I was assigned to pretty early on, and I was assigned to Drew McIntyre. And I always dug that as a challenge. And I also felt like that was a good vote of confidence, you know, that they thought you were a very talented dude who could teach these young guys on the road.
Well, quickly, things are about to get broken. let me give you a little recap, courtesy of our friends at Wikipedia here. Hardy was suspended by Vince McMahon in story because he attacked Drew McIntyre after McIntyre lost to Kofi Kingston over the limit. He's able to get his revenge on McIntyre during the Viewer's Choice episode of Raw when chosen as the opponent for McIntyre, with general manager Theodore Long, holla holla, stating that Hardy was suspended from SmackDown, but not from Raw.
Wait, Teddy didn't put me in a tag match?
He did not, or make you go one-on-one with The Undertaker. So none of that. But on the following episode of SmackDown, Vicky Guerrero announced that, per orders of Vince McMahon, Hardy was indeed suspended from all WWE programming. But at Fatal 4-Way, Hardy prevented McIntyre from regaining the Intercontinental Championship, thus continuing the feud, of course, despite you being suspended. On the following edition of SmackDown, he was reinstated by Long and had a match with McIntyre, which Hardy won. And after the match, it was announced that McIntyre's visa had legitimately expired and was sent back to Scotland, thus ending their feud. What a clusterfuck this is. What do you think of all that, Matt?
Oh, boy. typical WWE booking. John, just let it play out.
Let it play out, which is, of course, a T-shirt you can get at BoxOfGimmicks.com alongside Spoken Matt Hardy, the Extreme Life of Matt Hardy shirt, Matt Fact, Matt Fiction, or the 5-5-5-5-star T-shirt as well, BoxOfGimmicks.com. But Matt, crazy there, legitimately crazy, and at a time where you're already feeling a little jaded by some of the WWE booking, this can't feel good.
Yeah, I mean, once again, like, I'm a survivalist, you know, whenever I'm out there, you know, in that environment, that's what I do. I survive and I make the most out of every opportunity I can. And, you know, obviously that scenario happening with the whole Drew McIntyre thing was very frustrating. But, you know, I was always just going to make the most out of whatever opportunity I had. I was going to try to, at least.
Drew McIntyre being given that mantra of the chosen one. What do you think of that?
That's a pretty big burden to bear when you're such a young talent, you know, especially getting the endorsement of Vince. I mean, it's a great thing, but it also, I feel like that's a lot to live up to when you're just starting anew, you know. I thought Drew was going to be great. I definitely knew he's going to be great when he showed me videos of being dressed up like the Hardy Boys jumping on his trampoline when he was a little kid, you know. So I thought he was going to have potential, and he eventually realized what that potential was years down the road. He had to leave WWE to do it, but I always thought he was going to be extremely talented.
Now, Matt, I mentioned that match on SmackDown. It went about 15 minutes. It was overseas. Do you have recollection of that match?
Which match?
It was the match with Drew McIntyre that afterwards his visa expired. You beat him in about 15 minutes on SmackDown in the UK.
Yes. Okay.
That win, it's June 22nd, 2010.
Right.
That is your last win on WWE television until WrestleMania 33 in 2017.
There you have it. It's some sort of Guinness World Record.
7 years in between. So the rest of the summer is a lot of losing for you. You team with CLP on a SmackDown July 6th, and you lose to Curt Hawkins and Vance Archer, who, as we know, is Lance Archer now. It's a 2-minute match. You're working guys like McIntyre, Ziggler, Kofi, Cody, Alberto Del Rio, and you're losing. Meanwhile, Jeff looks like he's on his way to becoming TNA champion over there. He's paired with some big names. I know it's fake. It's pro wrestling. It's fake. I hate to break it to you. But how difficult is it when you're a veteran performer and you're just constantly losing matches, especially when you're in your mid-30s here? You know that prime is starting to slowly slip away. I take this as almost a half-assed punishment on the surface for Jeff leaving and the circumstances surrounding that. Did you feel that way?
Yeah, there was definitely a part of me that felt that way. And it's very frustrating, you know, especially when you're someone who is as passionate as I am, and you're willing to work as hard as I would. I mean, I'm going to give you everything I have if I'm there. If I'm working for your company, I'm going to wave your flag and I'm going to give you everything that I have, you know, every fiber of my being. So, yeah, it was obviously very frustrating.
Did you express those frustrations to anybody? Were you properly going through channels of communications to try to change that in any way?
Some, but I will tell you, I mean, I should have been gone already at this time. I needed to go take care of myself.
When was your contract supposed to expire?
I want to say I was released towards the end of that year. I think I had almost a year left on what my deal was whenever I was trying to get out of. So I still had probably at this point we're talking about, you know, I'm like at 18 months out, a year and a half or so.
How difficult is that for a pro wrestler when you see something on the horizon there, but you also know that it's a really far way away?
It's one of those things. I look back, you know, at that time right now, and I just know, I just can't believe where my headspace was, you know, like just, I was in just such a bad place where I almost like didn't care. I would obviously go and I would work hard, but once again, like, you know, if I'm at that point where, you know, if I'm going to get a push or going to not get a push, it was just like kind of get through the day, you know, which is a very frustrating thing. When like when you lose your passion in pro wrestling, or that fire isn't fueling you anymore, it's almost time to like take a break or leave or whatever. But that's not a good and healthy place. It was like unhealthy that I didn't care as much as I should have cared, or that I cared before. Obviously, I was going to go there and I was going to work hard and do all that I could, but I needed to take time off, and I wish I would have done it earlier. Like if the now 2022, 48-year-old Matt Hardy could go back and tell that mid-30s Matt Hardy what to do, I'd say like, get your shit together, talk to someone, have a serious conversation, and let them know with conviction, you've got to go get your shit together.
What's sad about it is that you are somebody, as I've gotten to know you too, you care so much about every appearance that you make. You care so much about every match that you have. Pro wrestling is inherent to you. It's in your blood. Right. So when you reach a point of not caring about something you were so passionate about, and I've been in those shoes, in separate field, but in those shoes too.
Sure.
It's like heart-wrenching. It's gut-wrenching because it's all you ever wanted to do. And now all of a sudden you don't care about it anymore.
Right.
Were you feeling that way?
I mean, yeah, it got to the point where it was just, it really became a job. And
that's
pro wrestling has never been that to me. You know, it's always been a passion. It's just like, you know, I love doing this shit. I would do this shit for free, you know, but it became a job where it's just like, okay, well, this is what you do. You go here and you clock in, you do your work, you clock out and you make your money, you know, but just like the passion was sucked out of me. And that's what was the most frustrating. And if that is a case, something that you legitimately love and something you have this great affection for, it's time to take a break. You know, if you get to that point where it's just a job, you know, and you're like going through the motions, you know, I would go there and I would work hard and I would do my thing. But in the big scheme of things, it felt like I was just going through the motions to do my job.
Your last match in WWE is September 11, 2010. It's a loss to Dolph Ziggler in the UK. Did you have any indication that this was going to be it for you?
Maybe. I mean, I knew I wanted to go, but also I was kind of being a bitch about it. I don't think I was addressing it, you know, the correct way. I wasn't taking the proper channels, and I wasn't like standing up and just saying like, look, guys, I'm broke the fuck down. I'm beat the fuck up. Physically, mentally, emotionally, and I needed to really stand up and state that with conviction, and I didn't. And I know there was that big controversy of like, you know, me getting sent home from that UK tour, right? What ended up happening that day is before, just because I was so beat the fuck up, I had taken a couple pain pills and maybe a Soma or whatever, and like I started dozing off at catering earlier in the day, and that is what ultimately led to me being sent home from that UK tour.
Who came up to?
I think ultimately I feel like Fit Finlay was the producer there, and I feel like this was just he'd buzz back to the main office, and he was the one that did it. And I was, and once again, I was a big bitch at that time. just even about like dirt cheats and stuff too. And I'll go ahead and say that ahead of time. But like now I've really learned, like, when you do some shit, you have to own it, like be accountable for it. And if like, this is the biggest thing I can say to any wrestlers who would get upset with dirt sheets or like, you know, internet, you know, news reporters who are just doing their gig, doing their job. Like, if you don't want bad shit out there on you, don't do bad shit. You know, there can't be a story if you have your shit in check, you know, and I didn't have my shit in check at that time. And I got very offended by it. And I really dislike my mentality at that time, because I was very much a bitch. And it bothers me when I see people that like bitch about, well, the dirt sheet said this, or it's wrong, or they're lying. Like, man, fuck, like, own that shit, man. Be accountable. And that's one of the biggest lessons I learned from that point in my life.
Speaking of dirt sheets, I'm going to be reading some excerpts from the Observer at the time, because Dave actually did a pretty good job chronicling everything that was going on with you. And he said after that match, Matt Hardy's future, and this is the lead story in the Observer, said Matt Hardy's future in WWE is in question regarding a behavioral issue that's being kept quiet that took place in Europe. And he mentions you being taken off the house shows, that you did fly home with the rest of the company, but then you were put on lead. And he said that there had been some concern for at least a few weeks on you. They had Cody Rhodes on SmackDown deliver a heel promo making fun of Hardy's weight gain, ironically coming after Hardy had lost some weight, which is said to be a message like the ones Mickey James and Serena didn't get and were eventually let go. Do you remember that being a message to you?
I do. I remember Cody was very nervous about even saying that. I said, that's fine, man. They want you to say it, just say it. It's fine. It's cool. Don't sweat it. It's all right. And it's one of those things too. That's like such a fucked up way to deliver messages, you know, but that's such like a WWE thing. I remember when they did that thing with Mickey James, they were calling like Piggy James.
It was ridiculous.
Brutal.
Ridiculous.
Brutal, man. You know, it's just like, I mean, if you have someone that you have an issue with, if you have to address, it's almost like me with my children, my sons. Like if I have an issue with, you know, Maxwell or Wolfie or Barty, you know, I take them and I set them down and I talk to them. I give them a stern talking to. I mean, and I feel like that's how wrestling should be handled, as opposed to like not really saying anything, you know, like in real life, in real time, actually just trying to make an example out of you on their TV show with these fictional characters and fictional promos. You know, it's just so weird. Just such a weird way of doing business.
So you post the video from your UK hotel room to the internet. Mm-hmm. You didn't address being taken off the shows. You said things were fine, that there's probably some changes coming, but there's a lot of fallout from this. People in WWE are concerned about you, but others, according to Dave, were unhappy, given that Hardy, a WWE wrestler, showed the Pro Wrestling Torch website on his computer during the video and talked about his being sent home being a headline and questioned why it was more of a headline than the main event on a house show, the death of a wrestler, Mike Shaw, and read that Cena's movie bombs, the latter of which infuriated those in the company because it was a talent exposing Cena's movie as bombing as being a story. Do you remember there being heat for that?
Oh boy. No, I actually don't remember any of that in detail. And probably a lot of points in my life around that time aren't remembered very well as it is anyway. But no, I do know one of those things, just like I was saying before, I was a bitch at that time, like very, very much like trying to like protect myself and not owning up to, you know, my flaws at that time.
Do you feel, and I don't know the answer to this, do you feel that you were being enabled at all in that time period?
I don't know if I was being enabled, but I just feel like the whole, I look back to when I asked for that time off, when I first got injured and beat up, and I hold a little bit of a grudge that they didn't take that serious. You know, like I had sacrificed so much, you know, especially those leg drops over and over and over again. You know, people like to joke about my walk or my hips and my low back, whatever, you know, but like, you know, I did that for, you know, their entertainment, you know, and to make a living. It's not like, this is something that I wanted to do to myself, obviously, but I do that bothers me that when I requested to have some time off and I was just said, oh, we'll go to the doctor, see what they can do. And they end up, you know, giving you pain pills and muscle relaxers. You know, I feel like not being able to get like a serious conversation, not addressing it you know, in the correct manner with me or the office. I feel like we were both at fault. I should have went to them. I should have said, like, look, like, this is a serious deal. Like, I'm hurt. I'm burnt out. I need to take time off. I need to go away. I need to be let go, or, you know, whatever, get out of my deal. And then I also feel like on their end too, it just, they should have also approached me like, hey, we seriously want to address this. We seriously want to address this. What can we do? What can we do? What can we do? As opposed to just feeling like a cog in a machine, you know? So I feel like that was kind of on both of us.
You harp on the intestines thing at this time, and you said that it was part of the reason why you bloated initially, and then you had lost a lot of weight because of it. And you blame the story getting out on a quote stooging punk, which was that a reference to CM Punk in particular?
I don't know. Maybe so at that time. I don't okay. know. I was a bit of a loose cannon at that time, so it certainly could have been, I guess. That's but fair. Once again, at the end of the day, I was the one that was being a bitch at that time.
Right. You say that when the time is right, you'll put everything out there as far as what really went down. You have to protect yourself and your brand, and you appreciate your fans, that you are appreciative of all the things WWE has gone through for you in the past. They've been gracious to you, but now it's time for a decision.
And John, I'm actually, we're putting it out there today, right here on the Extreme Life of Matt Hardy. I guess this is going to hold true because we're putting everything out there right here, right now.
I want to ask you, because this is a motif that you keep going back to, what really went down. Mm-hmm. That almost seems like something that people who find themselves backed against the wall always say. Well, you know, wait till you hear the true story. Wait till you hear all that. Mm-hmm. Were you trying to make justifications for yourself and your behavior?
Absolutely. Yeah. I own that. Yeah, I was.
Is that something that, again, me asking, mm-hmm. is that something that a lot of addicts or people who are going through those types of issues find themselves doing in terms of making excuses?
Absolutely, without a doubt. I mean, and once again, it was just like I knew I was in this. I knew I was going down this path, and I like had to change course, and I'm trying to protect myself and, like, you know, my image as much as possible, I guess, while doing so.
I guess it's just so striking for me because I know how seriously you took your job and now mm-hmm. you're just making excuses. It's a weird change, especially since when you're following that whole train of thought of, oh, here's what really happened. Wait till you hear what really happened. Well, a lot of what's happening is very much in plain sight. People can see you're not the same person that you once were.
Sure.
So unfortunately, that tracks with a lot of those breakdowns that you see that happen with celebrities. And I empathize because living a celebrity life cannot be easy. It cannot be easy, especially when every airport, people are coming up to you. Every hotel, people are coming up to you. Is that adding additional stress to your life?
But not as much with me. I was very accepting of that. And I just kind of knew that was part of the gig and that didn't bother me too much, but obviously, I feel like once you have some sort of notoriety, and when you're in the public spotlight, you know, and everything is seen, everything is judged, that can be a very tough scenario. And for me, it was then, because, like, I didn't want people to think, like, he's a bad guy that's doing bad things, you know. And that's I'm sure that's why I tried to cover things up as much as possible. I can tell you this: whenever I left WWE, I remember there was like the whole pill thing like dwindled down greatly at that point, because I knew I didn't have to take bumps and I didn't have to put this pressure on myself to like go and deliver and perform and, you know, wrestle like I did 10 years ago or 15 years ago, whatever, you know. So that was a positive. With that being said, because it's really like one of those things where it's like a vicious cycle once you get in that, you know, like if you know you have to wrestle every single night, like you get up, oh, you're beat up, you have to take this, and you know, now you kind of loosen up a little bit, now you can work out so you can keep your body strong, and then you have to take a little more so your body doesn't tighten back up again, then you have the match, then after the match you have to take a couple more, you know, it's a real vicious cycle, John. And then I was just like trying to break that cycle without doing the least amount of damage possible to me. I think that was my mentality at that time. But also, I was going about the wrong way because I was just so outspoken. And once again, it was very much, you could see this guy was like going through it in real time, right? You know, so it's like I was just trying to protect myself as much as possible to try and salvage as much value of myself as I could.
A few weeks after that first video, you put out another video. And you say that about 6 or 7 weeks prior, you discovered something, and that when you did, that you want to get your release. Dave speculates that that's around when you found out that Jeff was going to turn in TNA and become a big-time main event guy there. That you wanted out of WWE to go to TNA, and then you started working an angle on WWE management where you pretended to be screwed up so you'd be sent home and released. You said that your behavior that got you pulled from a house show in White Plains and a second show on the European tour was an elaborate work on the company to get yourself released. And you tweet a couple of different things here. You say, I've signed all my paperwork to be gone from the WWE. It's on their end where the sticking point is. Do they not want me to, there's a typo. Do they not want to let me go? Why would they be afraid? Over the past year, the Matt Hardy they've presented hadn't really been a threat. Just let me go. Let me go somewhere. Let me be a threat, because I will be. I promise you. So now you're backtracking here. And you're saying, no, this was all work. This is all work. And I just want to go. I want to be let go. You kind of allude to not being happy with the booking in that. So let's break that down, Matt. Mm-hmm. The thing that you found out, that you discovered, that led to you wanting to get your release, did that have to do with Jeff in TNA at all?
I think it was, yeah. And okay. And I was doing these crazy videos. I started, which was insane looking back at, just so fucking unprofessional. But like I was doing like crazy videos, trying to play things up as much as possible to get out of my deal.
The whole, no, this was an elaborate work to fool management thing. Was that Matt Hardy just trying to be smarter and one step ahead of everybody else in your mind at that time?
I think so, yeah. But I wasn't in the best state of mind to to pull off something like that. But yeah, I'm sure that that's what I was attempting to do.
You have so much respect from your colleagues in the industry. And then stuff like this is happening. Do you remember anybody reaching out to you and saying, Matt, I don't know if this is the right way to go about doing business here?
I don't know. I don't remember anyone specifically, but I think it was just, we were at that point where I really had put myself on an island to myself. You know, that's kind of where I had booked myself, because I was doing all this, you know, insane stuff, trying to harp on getting away. And it was just like, once again, there's a lot of pressure that this job can put on you, but you have to handle it the correct way. And I was not handling it the correct way.
There's an interesting point Dave brings up in The Observer. He says, the other thing that is that a lot of the dressing room is actually fully supportive of Hardy, feeling that his biggest complaint that he was over far more than his push, and it was one of the things for guys who were also over to be pushed in front of him, but there was a real resentment of how he was used to get McIntyre, who wasn't ready at that point, over, and how Hardy wasn't given a shot when SmackDown was in desperate need of babyface talent. So clearly Dave is talking to other people in the locker room here, and they are expressing to him, hey, we understand where Matt's coming from, but he's not doing this the right way. So nobody in the locker room at that time is talking to you directly about this stuff?
I mean, not really. There's not like someone like trying to like do a course correction and talk me out of doing what I'm doing. I mean, I always got along. I mean, I was getting along fine with people, but I think also people probably could feel that something was going on with me. And I may not have been, you know, the guy they wanted to necessarily be associated with at that time, because I was kind of going scorched earth on WWE at that time to try and get out of my deal.
Was there anything that somebody could have said to you, or if somebody had reached out and extended an offering hand, could that have smoothened things over, solved anything at that juncture, or were you hellbent on wiping the slate clean and getting the hell out of Dodge?
I mean, I feel like if someone from WWE would have really reached out with me with like a genuine, compassionate concern, and we'd had like a genuine, legit conversation, maybe, but I do remember my mentality of just like, regardless of what it was going to take, I wanted to get out of my deal. I wanted to get away. at that time. I mean, I was burnt, and once again, I wasn't doing it right. But I can't state enough how wrestling felt like a job, and it was just like this huge burden on me at this time, and like I just wanted to get away. And I knew deep down I was in this fucking weird, messed up, dangerous, vicious cycle, and I had to change it to some degree. And I think in the back of my mind, it was just like, you know, if I can get away from WWE, I can break this vicious cycle. And I'm pretty sure that's what my mentality was.
I just say that all because I believe it's important for you to look out for your peers. And I'm not blaming anybody in the WWE locker room for not doing enough to look out for you or anything like that. But if you ever see a friend or a coworker who's not in a great place, never hurts to check in on them. I think that's just a valuable lesson that people can take away in life, because that goes a long way, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. And I do. I feel like that now. I mean, there's times where if I see someone else that's going through it, you know, I'm would be one of the first ones to like, hey man, you want to talk? Can I help? What can I do? How can I help make things better? You know, and I feel like that's just, you know, that's kind of like my responsibility as a fellow human being and also a fellow colleague of someone that is busting their ass trying to do pro wrestling in a locker room.
Did they ever approach you about going to rehab?
I think, yes, towards the end, they did. I think they offered it. And then I just said, I just want to be out of my deal. I can take care of myself. And I feel like the stipulation was I had to go do like a 4-day assessment at a rehab. And I went and did that, and I was able to breeze through it pretty easy. I don't think they thought I could do it, but I obviously did. And then I went and did that, and that's what ultimately led to me getting my release from WWE.
So you get your release October 14th, officially. Mm-hmm. They let you go. Did you take it as a mutual release, or did you take it as a firing?
I think I took it as a mutual release just because I had to fight for it, you know, and like, I was asking to be released. And then once again, they said, okay, well, if you can get through this assessment, we'll send you to this place for 4 days. And if you can get through this assessment, then we'll give you a release. You know, so I had to work for it. You know, I just couldn't get them to write out fire me, you know.
One thing that's going on at this time too, is Linda McMahon's running for Senate. It's mm-hmm. a pretty big deal. The company's cleaning up across the board. And there's some speculation at the time that them just letting you go, knowing that you could show up in TNA in a few months.
Right.
That had to do directly with them not wanting any baggage attached to the Linda McMahon Senate campaign. If you had Soma stuff or painkillers or whatever.
Right.
You don't want something happening to one of your employees when you got someone running for public office. Do you feel like there was any attachment to that?
I'm sure they correlated. You know, I would imagine, you know, once again, when you have someone like a Linda McMahon running for an office, you want to make sure that, you know, your company seems like it's on the up and up and that you take care of all your employees and you want to have, you know, put forth the best reputation possible. So, yeah, I could definitely see that being influential in it.
You released the following statement. I swear it was harder for me to get released than it was to get hired. This is absolutely what I want. Now I can be me. I want to thank WWE for giving me an opportunity, and I thank all the people and friends who helped me there. But I had to move on to be happy. I want to thank JR, who hired me, Michael Hayes, who taught me so much, and Vince for letting me make a living and learn from him for 12 years. While some of you may look at this as an ending, I promise you this is the motherfucking beginning for Matt Hardy. Now I can create change. First off, motherfucking is spelled MUTHAFUCKING, which is the most Matt Hardy thing that I've ever seen in the first place. But do you remember having any final conversations with Vince as all this stuff was going down?
No, it wasn't really a Vince conversation. It was a John Laurinaitis conversation, finishing everything.
Do you feel like you had closure with Vince?
No, I didn't. I mean, that's why it was very important for me to return in 2017 and go out the right way and be a model employee. You know, and I definitely felt like it's funny that I did that whole angle with like the HFO and private party about paying my penance and making amends. I mean, but that is actually why I was very excited and I very much wanted to return to WWE and make things right and make amends. And I did during those 3 years I was there.
Just because Vince probably sees guys like you and Jeff as almost like his kids. Like, you guys were kids when you came up in that era, and both of you were pushed as big time stars. And not only that, you delivered big time money matches for him.
Mm-hmm.
So seeing you go through that, even though he may not have expressed that to you, I'm sure that can't have been easy. It could not have been easy for a guy like Vince to see you going through that stuff. And now things coming to an end on these terms. It's tough. And there's an interesting line from Dave in the Observer. I'm curious what you think of it. He says that everyone at this time believes you're TNA bound, and adds that Matt had been frustrated, and whether you want to believe everything was a work on the company from his side to get a release or not, he was saying that he was adamant about not winding up as the next hardcore Holly. It's an interesting comparison. I get what he's saying. You don't want to be a guy who's just kind of stuck there, not really having a whole lot to do, being used to put guys over. You felt that you could contribute more. Is that the right comparison that he's making? And was there any truth to a statement like that?
I think the most important aspect of everything was I just felt like I was kind of boxed into a corner, you know, with them being, when I felt like they were taking out their frustration of Jeff going to TNA on me. And I felt like I was very limited into how much I could progress there. I just wanted an opportunity to have a clean slate and start anew. That was my mentality, you know, and sometimes too, and I feel like I've learned this now more than ever. I mean, you have to take time away and maybe go to a different place or like freshen up. Like it's not a bad thing for your career path. It helps you. It helps you stay fresh in many different ways if you do change company. So it's something I should have probably done before that. I almost wish I could have just like left with Jeff at that same time if our deals had been aligned or whatever. But like I should have been off before, first and foremost, to take care of the health and well-being of, you know, the human being, Matt Hardy, more than anything else.
This is the first time you're out of the confines of the WWE system in more than a decade, not counting the brief period in 2005.
Right.
Is it a good thing for you to be on your own here, or is it a bad thing? And I ask that because we know you're going through some stuff. You're off the road, but you're also going through some stuff.
I was those 3 months I took off between my WWE release and TNA, like my pill usage dropped greatly. So that was a positive thing. I knew like I just had to change. I just it felt like the weight of the world was kind of lifted off my shoulders too. And then once again, I wasn't putting my body through the physical abuse that it was, you know, suffering week in and week out at that time. So that was a positive thing. What was it, the best place for someone to be who, like, you know, is still dealing with a pain pill issue? Maybe not. But I can say with confidence that I was better during that time when I was off.
How did you perceive yourself in this time period?
I was very frustrated that I had fallen to that, I think, that I had became something I was so against back in the days, you know, especially being someone who was so reliant on, you know, pain pills and muscle relaxers to be able to go and wrestle a match and like kind of get through the day. So I was definitely very frustrated with myself during that time, but I also, even then I feel like I was optimistic that I could turn things around and get back on the right path once again.
As you said, there's a few months between you leaving WWE and you end up going to TNA in January of 2011. How long was your non-compete?
90 days.
90 days, okay. We're going to talk about your TNA run at a later date in depth, but you were there from January through June.
Right.
And on June 21st, 2011, you get suspended, reportedly for being late to events. And just a few days earlier, you had tweeted, "Between dates, injuries, and outside issues, I'm going to have a few weeks off, and I'm ecstatic. The Matt Hardy movement is going into full effect." I know you're painting optimism publicly there.
Mm-hmm.
But it feels like that's somewhat of a cover for what's actually going on, at least Correct. From the public perception.
Yeah. Yeah. And once again, just getting back into the groove and just wrestling once again. And I was trying to wrestle the way that I wrestled, you know, 10 or 15 years ago. And then once again, the whole pain pill muscle relaxer issue came up again. And it once again got heightened. And it was during that time when I had that suspension and I was off for that amount of time is where I told myself, I did a cold, hard look in the mirror and I said, Matt, you have to stop. You have to stop. And then I like every day I would take like a little less, a little less, a little less. And then I remember trying, you know, I went a few days without doing stuff and like the withdrawals were real bad, whatever. And I had my wife with me at that time and she was helping out as well. And whenever I got in trouble out of that, which we'll talk about in a second, when we had, you know, the DUIs, all that stuff came from, I had stopped taking pills. And then a buddy of mine said, oh, there's this synthetic Xanax you should take. Ex-buddy of mine now, that you should really try. I said, I think this would help you so your withdrawals aren't that bad. And that is some stuff that he had given me. And it ended up being almost like a bath salt. And that is when I got in the trouble during that span of like 2 weeks. I'd stopped taking pills. And then he gave me something else that was supposed to be much safer and better, but it ended up being way worse. And that is when I got in those problematic situations.
Matt Hardy's become.
I've never said that before publicly, too. This is a first.
I appreciate you sharing that. Mm-hmm. Matt Hardy is someone that is going from this universally beloved young gun from North Carolina, this great endearing story. You've triumphed in the face of tragedy. You've risen above so many roadblocks in your path. You have this iconic TLC career. You do V1. It's a great story. And now all of a sudden, a few years later, anytime Matt Hardy's name starts to come up, it's, what do you do now? What's the situation now? What's going on now? Were you cognizant that the public perception was changing of you at that juncture?
Yes. Yes.
How difficult was that for you to wrangle with?
Pretty difficult. It was very frustrating. And it was just like one of those, it was one of those periods in my life. It's just like, I needed to make things right. And I had to get out of this mess that I was in. And I knew that it was just very hard to do at that time, you know? So I knew I had to change. I had to get my shit together. It was just very, very challenging and very difficult to do.
On top of that, Jeff is also going through some shit at this time. Mm-hmm. He has the Victory Road incident, which, if anyone's aware of wrestling history, you know, he showed up to a main event of a pay-per-view, not ready to wrestle at all, and they had to do a quick finish, and the match lasted a minute against Sting. And he goes away for a while, too. So you're both struggling at this time. Did Jeff struggling fuel your struggles, or did it help you find common ground?
Because
you're an independent guy. You are not Jeff Hardy. Jeff Hardy is not you. But
yeah,
that's a lot of heavy stuff to be going through together at the same time.
Yeah,
it's so crazy, Matt, because it's just a year and a half after both of you were world champions.
Right. I feel like we were both in the mud. We were both in the trenches, you know, trying to dig out. And we both knew we had to do things to change ourselves. And we had to correct, you know, our paths. And I guess there's some scenarios where we probably enabled one another during that period. And then there were some times where I would, you know, look at something when, you know, Jeff had that Victory Road incident. Like, I remember seeing him earlier, like a couple matches. I remember I wrestled with AJ on that show. I remember. And I was happy with the match we had. And then I remember coming back and talking to Jeff like, oh, yeah, good luck. Kill it, kill it, kill it. And then I remember someone telling me right before he went through the curtain, like, oh, my God, did you see Jeff? Like, he could barely walk going out there. Like, he got fucked. Like, that had just happened so instantly before that. I guess, you know, whatever. Before the match, he had taken whatever he had taken. But it was obviously too much, you know, or he hadn't eaten or whatever it may have been. And I remember feeling so bad for him. And I was like, fuck, man, how did, and I hated that just happened to him, that whole scenario. But I can tell you this with confidence. After the Victory Road incident with Jeff, Jeff swore off and said he would never take a pill again. And he damn sure did, which was pretty amazing because he did change everything around from that aspect. Later, alcohol was a whole different beast for him, but you know, there was a point too in my life, you know, where you know, if we go a little deeper in this episode, and I think we will, where there was that point where I said, okay, this, I will never, ever find myself in this scenario again, because it's the worst. It's brutal, you know, and that was that point of like, you know, all the lights come on and you realize like, I have to make a change and I have to stick to my guns and live life the right way.
On August 20th, do you have anything else there?
No, I was just going to say, fortunately, I was able to make it to that point where I could turn everything around.
On August 20th, you get fired from TNA hours after being involved in a single car crash where you hit a pipe in a tree and you were arrested for DUI. And as you just said, that was for a synthetic Xanax. Is that correct?
Yes, that's what it was. Yeah.
You post this to socials, and this is really hard. Quote, when the side window's glass smashed into my face, arms, and neck, some of the blood that did felt almost angelic. I went from being afraid to die to feeling like I was almost being reborn with some sort of an absolute pure life force. It was the most amazing thing I've ever experienced. I felt like I just received the blood of an angel flowing inside me. I know this sounds crazy. Due to those, I only have urges to help people, and miraculously, all my vices are gone. That is really hard to read back, because it's clear you're, even after this incident, still not in a good place.
I mean, those synthetic Xanax that guy had given me to try and, like, you know, wean off of your pain pills and muscle relaxers was the worst shit I'd ever taken. And even just like my state of mind was just insane during those couple weeks. And those couple weeks were like a blur. And those are the times that I got in all that trouble. And then I knew once I went away and once I first went to rehab, which is quite a story in itself. There was a point in time where I just like looked in the mirror and I said, like, dude, this is it. no more of this.
Yeah. How bad was that accident? How close to being very seriously injured were you?
I was fine. I was cut up a little bit, but it wasn't terrible.
Okay. Because the mugshot goes viral and it's a tough visual. And
then, oh yeah.
Just 10 days later, you post a video to YouTube where you say this. Goodbye, world. My time here is almost complete. I only have a few hours and minutes. I loved you all. Regardless of how you felt about me, I'll miss you all. September 23rd, 1974 to August 31st, 2011. And Matt, I remember this night so distinctly. You were so important to my childhood and one of those larger than life figures, truly, and millions of others out there. Mm-hmm. And I remember seeing this and just being so sad. At first I was concerned, obviously, but then when I realized what was going on here, I was just so sad. I thought it was a scummy thing to do. I thought it was shocking. It broke my heart. And there were nearly 30 calls made to local police for a welfare check on you that night. And you say that you meant this as a saying that the old Matt Hardy was dead, but obviously we're not sugarcoating things. This reads as a suicide note. And fans around the world are very concerned about you. What was the mentality here? And was this your lowest point?
Yeah, I look back at that And I do. It was like fucked up. And I feel so bad that I posted that, even like for you to read or for anybody who did. And the intent was not to be a suicide note, which obviously it was formulated in that way. You know, let's not kid ourselves here. But the point was to say, like, okay, we're trying to start again. We're trying to start again. This is something new. We're going to get it, you know, Matt's going to get his shit together, whatever. But just taking that path and trying to be so shocking, it's almost like when you have someone that has a creative mind like me, but it's not in the best place. And it's not thinking about how this is going to affect people that are reading it and how they're going to feel about it. So looking back at that, I really regret that. And I apologize to everyone, you know, even starting with you right here, John, I apologize to everyone who read that, because it was just, once again, there was there was never a thought in my mind about committing suicide, obviously. But it was just trying to take a shocking path, but it was the wrong path, and it was just so bad and so fucked up and so poorly done.
I was even getting emotional when I was doing the notes for this and I was writing about that, because it brought me back to that night, like being in the same spot, just looking at my computer and seeing that Windows Movie Maker video. I remember the text and everything that it looked like. It's because I was so, there's so much concern and sadness that somebody who you really care about, I didn't know you at the time, obviously, but I cared about you, as did so many people. So many people cared about you. Was there ever a realization as you start to turn the corner here that, wow, I do have a lot of people that give a shit about me?
I think so. It was pretty shocking. There were cops that did come to my house to check on me. And they told me they got this outrageous amount of calls and whatnot. So, yeah, I mean, it was just sad. I was just like I was in a very sad, pathetic place in my life to actually put that out there, you know? Yeah. So once again, it was, I feel like in some ways, like a cry for help, maybe. Yeah. You know, it's like, I want to start, I want to be better. I want to start anew. I want to, you know, get out of this groove and get back to being me, get back to being old Matt Hardy, you know, but I just went about it all the wrong way.
For the record, I don't think you're scum. I mean, outside of the time you were literally scum, I don't think you're scum. I think that you have really, truly come such a long way. And even though this is rock bottom for you, you've got colleagues, Jim Ross, even Shane Helms, they're all calling you out publicly. And they're saying, what the hell is this?
Right.
And
rightfully so.
Did it serve as a bit of a wake-up call for you at all?
Yeah, I mean, I knew it was a bad decision.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty instantly.
Yeah. The next week, you say your full-time wrestling career is over. Good old wrestling retirement there, Matt Hardy. We know that doesn't ultimately last, but you do take a step back from working as much. And within the next year, there are significant changes in your physical being, your mental well-being. Things look like they start to stabilize a little bit. What do you credit that to?
Well, first and foremost, I got to give a shout out to my wife, to Rebby, who was there, and like she was on my ass through all that, and it was a time where I needed someone to be on my ass. So I have to give her credit, because she really stuck with me and hung with me through all that, you know. And there was a time where, you know, with WWE, I did reach out to them, and they talked about doing rehab, you know, and we did go to rehab, but this was also a point where I learned I always wanted to make decisions for myself. I had someone who was helping me with like legal issues and whatnot. And the place that they chose to send me for rehab was like a 90-day program, you know, and it was through WWE. And I think she just thought like it was the better one, probably because it was the more expensive one. And, you know, maybe it's more time, whatever, but it ended up being the 90-day program was for people that had been in rehab, 8, 9, 10 times. And it was more or less like a more laid back rehab, like either, you know, you got to get this right or you're going to die. That was kind of the vibe of all the guys I was in there with. And I was like a first time guy who just needed someone on their ass nonstop, you know, and I learned some good lessons through rehab like that. And it was a very famous story. And I've never shared this before. I'm going to share it right here. So I go and I'm doing these 90 days of rehab. And it's in Hazleton in Minnesota. And, you know, as soon as I walk in, like several of the guys immediately know who I am. They're like wrestling fans and they're doing this. And, you know, for, you know, the first 30, 40 days, you know, all real good, you know, like no pills. And I'm able to get through the withdrawals and everything else. And like, I'm good. And I knew I was set. I knew from that point on, about 30 or 40 days in, I knew that my days of taking any pills were going to be over. Like, you know, if I go back and wrestle, I just have to change how I wrestle. And that was one of the biggest lessons I learned during that time, because I like still put this pressure on myself, you know, towards the end there to like, I have to wrestle like I did when I was 25 years old, which isn't physically impossible once your body has so much wear and tear on it and so many bumps are off your bump card. So, the days of no longer taking pills were coming up. I was done with that. I was past that, you know, and I got through and I knew they'd put me in such a shitty groove. And there was a guy named Vance that was there who was a camera operator, seemed to be a real cool dude. He'd followed wrestling. He said he actually did something kind of like as a freelance guy at a WWE event one time. And he said, "Hey," he said, "come over here. There's a couple guys in rehab, you know, like come to my room on Tuesday nights. You know, they let us go to, you know, go out shopping to the Walmart or whatever one day a week. Say, hey, I want to show you guys something." And I go in his room and I know he like lifts up like the tile in the ceiling and he turns around, he pulls out like a bottle of Jack Daniels. And this is in rehab. And he's like, "You know, we just have some, you know, we have like a little Tuesday night sip, whatever." And there were a couple Tuesdays like back to back where like there were three other people, Vance, me, and these two other guys, where we'd like have a couple sips of Jack Daniel in a rehab. And I was like, this is fucking crazy. Like, I didn't think rehab's supposed to be like this, whatever. That ended up getting out. We got busted for that and we got booted out of the rehab. And whenever I was on the plane flying back home, because of my legal troubles, I'd said I was going to go to rehab and finish this, but you know, I'd done 60 days at this point. And I remember our plane was landing in Raleigh and they said, "Ladies and gentlemen, please keep your seat." They said, "The authorities are outside. We have someone that is going to have to be arrested, you know, whenever we land. So just let them go first." And I remember like, you know, and I'm sober as shit right here. And I said, "Don't worry, ladies and gentlemen, it's me. You guys don't have anything to fret. Don't worry about it. It is me. This is on me." And I knew right then and right there, my fucking Jesse James days, they were done. That was it. And I'll never forget, like, walking up, I was like, "How are you, officers?" Stuck out my hands. And then, you know, they took me, and I had $1 million bail, John. A $1 million bail, which is so crazy. And and that, for sure, doing a little over a week, you know, sitting in a little cell, that's like, no more of this. I'm done. I'm done. Changes are definitely coming. And then I left there and I went to a regular 30-day rehab where they're like on your ass. And even like at night, they come look in your room every 20 minutes or whatever, just to make sure you're there. I mean, that's what I needed right from the jump. And that's why it really made me think like, no, I have to make decisions for myself. I can't like insure someone else to do what's in my best interest. I have to be able to man up and do what is going to be in my best interest. But that was the turning point where I truly changed. Like, all those videos or those messages where I said, "Oh, you know, the Matt Hardy movement has begun," or, you know, "I'm doing this, I'm being reborn." That was the moment where I'm like, man, fuck this. Like, life is too good and I got it good. Like, you know, I've got my shit together finally, and I'm going to keep my shit together. And there's no more backsliding. There's no more going backwards. Like, do things right and do things legit, be transparent, and like fucking own your shit.
Do you think you'll ever share with your kids the extent of what you went through?
Yeah. Yeah. Most likely.
Why?
I mean, it's going to be there for them. And the reason I would share with them is just so they'd never make the same mistakes. You know?
When you see what you've been able to accomplish post all of this, 10 years on, how proud of yourself are you for being being able to overcome those hurdles?
I am proud, but also too, like, I don't want to pat myself on the back that much because it's shit that I should be doing anyway. You know, like, I've been given this amazing opportunity. I've been given this amazing life. I've been able to make a really good living. I have a beautiful wife. I have four beautiful children. Like, I have it all. Like, there's no reason for me to be fucking up. I mean, that's my mentality. You know, I have it all. There's no reason for me to be fucking up.
Let's get some Ask Matt questions in here, because we had a lot of people who were curious about this journey and everything. A wrestling historian who always puts us over on Instagram every week, so we appreciate that. He asks, what's your best advice to people struggling with addiction? Thank you in advance.
I mean, you have to, first and foremost, you have to realize and identify that you have a problem. And then you can't be afraid to ask someone for help. I mean, it's a lot of people get embarrassed. You know, once people, if someone becomes addicted to whatever it may be, you know, whatever kind of drugs or pills or alcohol, whatever, you know, and there's even other stuff that aren't necessarily chemicals that people can become addicted to. You have to be able to realize that there's a problem, and then you can't be afraid to ask for help. Don't be embarrassed. Like, ask for help, you know, and do what you need to do to get right again.
And we did a whole episode on mental health and addiction too, that you can check out in our archives, where Matt talked extensively about that stuff. So go check that out as well. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that question. Max asks, though it was an extraordinarily tough time, both personally and professionally, are there any fond memories or moments that Matt recalls from that time period?
I mean, you know, there's always good times too. I hate when, you know, when people are going through stuff, you know, there are highlights in periods like that, in good moments, and you have
meeting Rebbe in that time period.
Yeah, I mean that's definitely a positive thing. You know, that was right towards the beginning of 2011, which obviously that would change the course of my life in many ways. So that was certainly a positive. And I mean, there were a lot of times, even when I was in TNA in the very beginning. I mean, I had a lot of great times there. Even just once again traveling with Jeff and being with Jeff, it was just great to be reunited as brothers too, you know, and be able to work together, be on the same page. And there were good times through all that too, just like moments and instances, you know, that you have with guys, and just like genuine life moments where it's just like really enjoyable, you know, situations you find yourself in with people, you know, even though it was overall in the big scheme, it was a difficult point in my life.
Valerie says, your last match on TV in WWE that year was against Alberto Del Rio. I was just wondering, what was it like working with Del Rio? And do you wish that you had worked with him a lot more if you had stayed in WWE?
You'd like to roll that R, John. You're good at it.
Claro que sí.
Yeah. I enjoyed the couple times I worked with him. I enjoyed it. We had pretty good matches. I liked him. He was at that point in time, I mean, he was real easy to get along with and a cool dude, you know, so I've never had any issues with him, but I did enjoy working him at that point.
Mage Side says, it sucks because the 2010 Matt Hardy gear was top of the line. Should have bumped you into the upper mid card easily with that look. It was eye catching and just made you look ready to go. You like that gear that you were wearing at that time?
That's cool. There's definitely some gear. There was a pair of black pants that I had that were all blinged out that I like. They were black and purple. I like that outfit quite a bit. I like those pants.
Julian says, at that year, you left WWE, debuted in TNA 3 months later. In retrospect, could you have taken a longer break before going to TNA?
Yeah. I mean, I probably, looking back in hindsight, you know, hindsight's always 2020, obviously. I mean, I should have taken time off and got clean, totally got into a point physically where I wasn't dependent on painkillers if I was taking bumps or working or wrestling or whatever it may have been. You know, that's what I should have done, to do it appropriately. But once again, I just kind of jumped the gun, and I got excited to be wrestling again, and it felt like a passion and not like a job. So I jumped back in it a little too quick.
Let's keep getting a few more questions here. We got some great questions. I want to give our fans a chance here to get their voice heard. Josh asks, how important do you think it is for wrestlers to have some sort of off season, specifically having guys or girls taking some time off annually to avoid the burnout that could lead to more personal issues such as mental health or potential drug problems?
I mean, I think it is important that guys do have an allotted amount of time off every now and then, especially guys who've been around for a long time, or at least have a relaxed schedule. You know, that's one thing I think that is great about AEW. It's not nowhere near stressful as like a WWE schedule is. As far as having an off season, I think it would be something that would be interesting if guys kind of cycled around throughout the years. If you had some guys who were off for, you know, a month or 6 weeks at this point, and then, you know, 6 weeks later, there's another group of guys and girls off, and 6 weeks later, another group. I think that would be interesting. And I think it is important to have time off, especially if you are legitimately injured, you know, and you have to take care of that first and foremost, because we have to remember that these, you know, living, breathing superheroes that wrestle on live TV at the end of the day, inside these personas and identities, they're human beings made of flesh and blood.
Bryant asks, you would use YouTube as a way to help facilitate your release from WWE. At this point, how did you view YouTube as a social media presence? Did you feel YouTube would help get more attention towards your feelings about WWE at the time?
Yeah, I mean, I knew YouTube was a pretty strong tool then. You know, it was kind of coming into prominence. And I knew it was a big deal to be able to, you know, like record your own video, which was going to ultimately be your creative and whatever your message, whatever you wanted to be, not something someone was writing for you as a character or whatever. So I knew it would be beneficial. But once again, I wasn't in the best place in my life. So some of that stuff wasn't to my benefit as well that I also posted at that time.
Let's get three more quick ones in here, and then we'll send you on your way. Joey asked, did you know that Drew McIntyre was going to be the guy one day, or was he fit for a 3MB-like group?
No, I mean, I thought he had potential to be a great talent and, you know, a champion. You know, I thought that right from the jump. I mean, it was going to take time. There's no substitute for experience, but I definitely thought he had the potential to go all the way and be a champion.
Pat Pitts wants to know, what's one device or trick you use to keep going and block out negativity?
Optimism, maybe. That is definitely one thing. I just think the first thing I think about when negativity kind of like jumps out in front of you is just you have to remember all the positives in your life. You know, you have to remember all the good things you have. And I feel like so many people get so stressed whenever they have like, you know, a negative experience in their life, or they have someone being negative towards them, or something negative is happening. I feel like they just kind of dwell on that and they get stuck on the negative. But you have to remember the good things that are in your life. And those are the things that you need to work hard and you need to fight for and you need to be optimistic about. You know, there's always good things too. Like, don't ever just view the negative. Always remember the positives, because those are the things that can help lead you to a higher ground and get you through that. Those negatives.
Always a great piece of advice from you, Matt Hardy. And our last question is a good one. I think you're going to like this one. I told you I saw Gaslight Anthem last week. They covered a State of Love and Trust by your boys in Pearl Jam. And it got me thinking about music. And we got this great question from Matthew to wrap up. He says, I'm a music teacher by day, and we've been talking about how a theme song kind of tells the story of a movie, a person, or a character. So it got me wondering, what would Matt Hardy's theme song be for his career as a whole? And for his life outside of wrestling?
Long Road by Pearl Jam. There's actually a video that someone had just made, like a tribute video that had Jeff and I on it. You know, we all walked the long road. And it's a song that it's always kind of had a hold on me. And I think that fits, because it has been. It's been a long road. It's been a pretty amazing road, you know, and not any journey is going to be flawless. You know, there's going to be negatives in it, but once again, always reflect on the positives that surround you and that are happening, and keep optimist, keep that optimism, because at the end of the day, you can either look at the glass like half empty or half full, and always look at it as half full and always be optimistic. The ultimate optimist I am.
Did you ever envision at that time that you would get a chance to make right on things and go back to WWE?
I always had a feeling inside that I would. Actually, there were a couple times I had dreams about it, that I would return to WWE and make things right. So it was definitely something that was, you know, in my soul that I wanted to do. It was on my conscience, you know, so I wanted to do it. So I'm glad it worked out and it played out like it did.
And it got to happen in a dreamlike sequence with you returning in front of all those fans. And
yeah, it really did.
That's why I wanted to do this episode, Matt, because it really does help tell your story in full.
Yeah.
And
that's one of the things too, I stress to people over and over. I mean, like, whenever we did that documentary of the Hardys Woking with WWE, there was a point in time where I said, like, you know, as long as there's breath in your lungs, you know, as long as your heart is beating, you know, as long as you're alive, it is never too late to change. And you can't adapt that mentality that you can't change. You have to believe you can change. You have to stay optimistic. And no one's life is perfect. I mean, people are going to fuck up in life. You know, you're going to get some stuff right. You're going to get some stuff wrong. But at the end of the day, you just have to do your best to be your best and try and stay consistent. And if you have instances that happen, like this period of my life where I was talking about, it was such a rough time. I mean, I look back at it and obviously there's a part of me that is like disappointed that I did that. But also there's also a part of me that's very proud that I survived all that. And I got through that and I became better and stronger because of it, you know, and I chalk it up to a life learning experience. And I feel like If you're going through some shit out there right now, just know you can get through it. You are strong enough, and it will get better. And whatever the situation is that you're going through, you can learn from it. And you can also make yourself a much stronger and better person because of it.
There are a lot of people out there, Matt Hardy, who are happy that you got through this time period, myself included. We're grateful that you're still here with us. And I'm blessed every single week to get to do this podcast with you. It is a dream come true for me to get a chance to pick your brain every single week. And without you being able to weather that storm 10 plus years ago, I'm not sure if we'd be having this opportunity. So it's an extreme privilege on my behalf to get to help tell your stories. And it's not one I take lightly. So we're all very happy to see you thriving with a beautiful family. Happy anniversary to you and Rebbe again.
Thank you.
And I know how much you treasure every day and how much you treasure your kids. And your kids alone are your reason to wake up every single day. I know that. So that's big time stuff there, Matt. So we are grateful for you, my friend. And we are grateful for everyone for listening to this episode of The Extreme Life of Matt Hardy, especially those of you who leave those 5 Cinco 5 Cinco 5 star reviews, like Matt Ban Swag, who said this past week, "The podcast is wonderful. The show hosted by John Alba and the spoken one, Matt Hardy, is wonderful. They cover wrestling. They cover everything wrestling, but also touch on subjects that are inspirational and serve to help the listener. This podcast has been a mainstay in my listening habits since it began. Every week I have to get my fix. Matt Hardy is an idol for me and is someone who until this last weekend I was never able to meet, but I met him at AML Wrestling with a Matt Fact, Matt Fiction shirt on. He was very humble and was great to talk to. I'm blessed to have met him and now need to get John Alba in the Carolinas so I can meet him too." Matt Hardy, that sounds like that'd be a good idea.
Yeah.
Hypothetically speaking, of course, but pretty cool review there. I know you had a chance to meet him this past week and you took that picture with him.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. Yeah. For sure. What a great guy. Thank you so much for that comment. Thank you for checking out the podcast. And it was a pleasure meeting you. Thank you for rocking that Extreme Life of Matt Hardy shirt. We greatly appreciate it. And thank you so much. This is such a labor of love for myself and John. And we really pour our heart and soul into this. And thank you so much for listening to us and supporting us, man.
And next week, we celebrate 30 years of Matt Hardy. It is an anniversary celebration in its own right. You celebrate your 30 years in professional wrestling. You have no idea what's in store for you on that episode. I cannot wait. We've got some surprises. And we're just going to take a retrospect on what you've accomplished in your career and talk about some fun stuff. So I want to get everyone involved in this, Matt. If you're a Matt Hardy fan, if you're a Hardy Boys fan, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, however you want to reach out to us. Send us your favorite Matt Hardy memories and your well wishes for Matt as he celebrates 30 years. We'll pick some, we'll read them on air, and it'll be a lot of fun. So good way to get involved with the show.
I'm excited for it.
30 years, brother. Congratulations. That's very exciting. So you're not even in a wheelchair yet. Who would have thought?
So. Right. I was supposed to be in a wheelchair 15 years ago. That's how the vets book me.
That's right.
That's how the Anything old times book me.
Anything else you want to add here, Matt?
I just, once again, I really want to reinforce and stress, if there's anyone out there that is struggling and going through it right now and you're listening to this and you're not sure if you can make through it, like, I want to say to you, you can make it through it. If I can make it through it and you heard my story and I've made it through and I'm on the other side and much better off because of it, then you can too.
The words have been spoken. This has been The Extreme Life of Matt Hardy. We'll see you next time.